Hello, Marvelites! Welcome to This Week in Marvel, episode number 344. I'm Ryan Panagos, a.k.a. Agent Am.
And I'm Jamie Frevely, a.k.a. Agent Monochrome, because that's how I am dressed today. And
you're wearing white pants?
I know, I'm wearing black and gray. Monochrome is like the no colors, but you copied me. You were kind of both...
A black shirt on.
Yeah. He's adopted my uniform, finally.
Yep.
I've infected him with the venom.
This week is... A fun Spider-Man week.
Oh, it sure is.
We're going to talk about Amazing Spider-Man number 800 in our Picks of the Week in a little bit, along with Star Wars, Lando, Double or Nothing number 1, and Lockjaw number 4. So if you need to read up on those books before you listen to the rest of the show, do it now. Get on it.
I mean, this is the end of the Lockjaw run, so there's definitely going to be some spoilers. There's some culmination, and maybe not a spoiler, but there's puppies.
So there's puppies.
There are puppies, and it's wonderful.
It is wonderful. Part of what's so cool about Spider-Man this week is there are 9 billion covers to this issue. We did covers with legendary French artist Mobius. He did a bunch of pieces for us back, way, way back, maybe early 90s, late 80s. Some of them are actually up on display here at Marvel headquarters in various places. He has a really gnarly, weird Punisher. I've never seen the skull drawn the way he's done it, and it's downstairs. But his Spider-Man is really cool and creepy, and that's one of the variants. You get Frank Cho variant, Paolo Rivera with his dad, Joe Rivera, Mark Bagley, John Cassaday, Greg Land, Steve Ditko variant, tons more. And then there are some that were like made for retailers, some that are made for conventions. I saw a very cool one by Adam Hughes. So there'll be tons and tons of variants of Spider-Man 800. And it's fitting. It's a legendary, I guess it can't be legendary yet, but it is a landmark.
It is a landmark issue for sure. We have a few of these variants up on Marvel.com. So when you visit Marvel.com for more information on this show this week. I'll add a little link for you to check them out. But it's not even the last issue because 801 is, I think, the end of the run, right?
Yeah, 801 will be Dan Slott's final issue.
Yeah.
And that's coming up. That's with artist Marcos Martin. So we'll talk a little bit more about that soon. But another big piece of fun that we're celebrating is the 40th anniversary of the Japanese Spider-Man television show, which you just heard the theme song for, and yes, you're not crazy, just a little bit of funsies. We put in the greatest theme song in Japanese television, which is probably, that's probably not even true. Someone's going to correct me, but it's my favorite. Earth's Mightiest Show has a little segment up this week where you can see some snippets. Now, 40 years ago, shout out to Jordan Gibson, a.k.a. at Gibson Comics on Twitter, who initially pointed out the 40th anniversary to me. Spider-Man, that's the phonetic way, the translation for it. So you can say Japanese Spider-Man, you can say Spider-Man. It kind of both works. It's a tokusatsu series, which is essentially live action movie or TV show with special effects. So think kaiju movies, your Godzillas, your Gamoras, Power Rangers. So it's cool. I love... Very much love tokusatsu stuff. It's essentially a show about a dude. It has very little to do with the original source material of Spider-Man.
I'm actually fine with this because I feel like a Japanese Spider-Man deserves his own origin story. He doesn't have to be a Japanese Peter Parker.
Nope.
He is his own man. He's got his own origin, and he gets his spider powers from something very different.
Yeah. So his name is Takoya. He finds a spaceship called the Marveler, and it's dying pilot dude who's named Garia. Garia was the last survivor of Planet Spider, of course, as often happens. He's the last of his race. And Planet Spider was essentially destroyed by Professor Monster, one of the greatest villain names of all time.
It's the best. It tells you exactly what's going on there.
Yeah. Professor Monster is really cool. He has this like metal eye thing on his face. And he has an army called the Iron Cross Army, who one of his general, I believe it's the general or she's the leader of the army, is Amazonas. She's super cool. Then while Takoya is talking to Garia, Garia's like, you need to help me. Garia injects Takoya with some of Garia's blood, which gives Takoya some spidery type powers. It's not quite the same, as how Peter gets bitten by the spider, but he also gives Takoya a bracelet, and the bracelet provides Spider-Man's suit, gives him web shooters, which the web shooters do like spider nets and spider strings is what they call it in the show, and a bunch more. And the bracelet is also how Spider-Man calls Marveler. You know, when he needs the ship, he's like, hey, ship, come get me. And then it also turns the ship into Leopardon, this giant fighting awesome robot, which is actually one of my holy grails for toys. In the early 80s, it was actually made as a toy here in the States. I've never gotten it. And like, there's really cool stuff because as part of this deal way back when, Toei, who is the production company who makes this, who's legendary in Japanese entertainment, live action, cartoons, and all this other stuff. Toei and Marvel had this cool deal. So Marvel actually was able to do some stuff with Toei properties. Toei did some stuff with Marvel properties. I believe they also did the Tomb of Dracula anime, which is really cool, very 70s anime style, like Captain Harlot type of, like that kind of really cool animation.
And Blade was in that comic here, so I know what I'm looking for as soon as I get back to my computer.
So as many fans of Marvel Comics in the 70s know, Marvel produced Shogun Warriors comics. And Shogun Warriors was a great line of really big toys. Mazinger Z, the line of toys pulled in different robots from different series. So it's really cool. There's this mix and match and sort of sharing of fun that I think really helped a lot of kids get excited about different things. And so Leopardon is a toy that I really, really want just because I love this show so much and it's really neat.
My favorite things that I read about this show was that he had to, much like Peter Parker, protect his secret identity, and he acted weak around his friends. And I think that's always really funny when you know a guy you know is a hero and then he's like, I can't open this jar of pickles. That is what I automatically assume he was
classic
pretending
weak
to be
guy
weak.
Move.
Classic weak guy move, can't open this jar of pickles.
Yeah. You were talking about puppies earlier. There's a great episode where Spider-Man saves a puppy. He's in his flying car, which I think is really just driving at that point, if I remember correctly. And there's a little doggo on the side of the road. And he picks it up, and then he like takes it in his car, and he goes away. He keeps going. It's really great. For some reason, there's an episode where Spidey has he's shooting a machine gun. I don't remember why. But Takoya and Leopardon were in Spider-Verse, which is the 2014 Spider-Man big event. We actually, Dan Slott is a fan of this, of course, because Dan Slott is the best and he knows all kinds of crazy stuff. So they brought Takoya and Leopardon into it as part of the, you know, massive Spider-Verse crossover, which was really awesome.
That's miraculous to me.
I know.
But also keep in mind, this is a show that's 40 years old.
Yeah.
And it ran for 41 episodes and a movie. So this is not like MASH. It's not like it's been around forever, but it had such a huge impact on pop culture and Spider-Man fans around the world.
Totally.
And it's special, and that's why we're celebrating.
Yeah, so it's really cool. Hopefully you guys can find a way to check it out or just pull some clips, see some stuff on Earth's Mightiest Show's Facebook page. They're posting up some stuff from the program, and it's neat. So that is a little bit of celebration of Spider-Man. And I think from there, it's about time we talk about Amazing Spider-Man, number 800. This is 10 years in the making, and it's massive. There are 4 numbered chapters in this book, plus 2 epilogues, plus a post-credit scene.
It's like the Lord of the Rings version of Spider-Man, and it moves. You know, this is a comic that you're going to sail through it. It's 80 pages long, but it is a quick read.
Yeah, I mean, it moves. It goes there. It's at a breakneck pace because it's Spider-Man versus the Red Goblin. The Red Goblin being Spider-Man's greatest nemesis, Norman Osborn, the man who killed Spider-Man's girlfriend way back when, killed Gwen Stacy. He has haunted Spider-Man numerous times. He's come back again and again and again. And now, because of J. Jonah Jameson, Norman Osborn has learned Spider-Man's secret identity, which is the worst possible scenario. It gets worse, though, because he also has his goblin powers and his tech, his pumpkin bombs and his glider. He also now has the Carnage symbiote. That has been the whole storyline in Go Down Swinging. It's Spider-Man having to face an amped up and super dangerous Norman Osborn.
Which, that's just terrifying all by itself. Because the Goblin is already so sinister and creepy and insane. And now he's got Carnage.
Yep.
That's just a nightmare scenario.
Yeah.
You're right. This is the worst possible scenario.
This is about as bad as it gets. Unless you give Norman like an Infinity Gauntlet.
Yeah.
Or a Cosmic Cube. This is really, really bad. And he's very hard to fight, very hard to kill because he's got a symbiote. He doesn't set off Peter Parker's
Spidey sense.
He doesn't have as many vulnerabilities as he normally would or as a symbiote on its own normally would. It's like the end huge level in a video game where you've been fighting and you've beat this guy in this way and he's run off and you gun this way and you have to save these people and you're all these missions and this is the final chapter. I think of all like the video games I play, like, you know, Horizon Zero Dawn, you had like this end game where you had to go through this giant gauntlet and all these different things, or The Witcher, or, you know, any major video game where this is it. This is the most difficult thing and it's going to challenge everything that you've figured out and all your skills and all your abilities. And so Spider-Man has to take pieces from different characters. There's a great moment with Venom in here. There's stuff that he needs help from with Anti-Venom. There's a great moment with Clash, who's in here. Clash being this really cool villain that's shown up during Stan's run. He's gotten his butt kicked by the Red Goblin and he's just still, he hates Spider-Man. Like, he's got a love-hate relationship with Spider-Man. So Spider-Man has to like gear up, has to find ways to make himself stronger, faster, smarter. Friggin' Superior Octopus shows up. So it's Doc Ock and his sexy new sexy body. He shows up and it's like a really great moment that ties in with everything that Dan and the collaborators did with Superior Spider-Man, really paying off those relationships, the way that Ock connected with Aunt May.
Yeah.
The way, like, this is really a great culmination of 10 years of storytelling. So I talk a lot about Dan Slott, but, you know, Nick Lowe in the letters page does a great job of giving a sense of the importance for each artist during this run of Spider-Man, and in particular this issue of Amazing Spider-Man 800. We've got Giuseppe Camuncoli, Umberto Ramos, Nick Bradshaw, friggin' Marcos Martin, and the GOAT, as I like to say, Stuart Immonen. I love so many other artists. People ask me, what's your favorite comic? What's your favorite artist? What's your favorite writer? And a lot of it has to do with what I've read recently. But anytime you give me a book that is drawn by Stuart Immonen, and, you know, it's got usually like maybe Marte Gracia colors and Wade Von Grawbadger on inks. Yep, knew it without even looking.
Called it.
I got it. That is just one of the most solid, strong storytelling teams. The way they just frame a page and work together to produce what we look for. And you were just pointing out, Jamie, one of your favorite scenes in the book, which comes from the end of the issue with Spidey and Green Goblin, which is drawn by Stuart Immonen.
It's some very prime, terrifying-looking Green Goblin, who is, at this point, out of the Carnage.
Yeah, it's the only way to beat Goblin, Spider-Man thinks, is he has to go for what weakness Norman has, and that's his ego. You got to play
it's such
on
good storytelling.
Yeah, you got to play on what you know, and Norman has been using the Carnage symbiote to wreck so much havoc, and then you'd be like, dude, you couldn't beat me by yourself, and that just breaks Norman. It's such a great moment. So you have this two pages here, and it's this almost mirror image. One side is Spider-Man without any extras, and the other side is Norman in the Goblin costume without any extras. And it's just beautiful colors, the shading, the shadowing, the way that Stuart draws the menace coming off of Goblin, the just terrifying shapes and you know, shadows that everything about it is just gorgeous.
And I think what's so cool about these two panels is that if they could be looking in a mirror, they're almost posed the same way. And they're just, I want to say, like, evenly matched. It's just us now. It's like bare knuckle, completely stripped down. It's pure. And it's just, giving me chills.
Yeah. What has always been so interesting to me about Norman as a villain is he could be such an amazing hero or leader if he wasn't so driven by his ego, if he had gotten help, because he has mental problems and can be treated and can be helped, but he never went down that route. You know, he went down the path of stoking those flames, of going to dangerous places and getting worse and worse and worse. But he could be Tony Stark level. He's a brilliant inventor and scientist and businessman.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's a great what if story that is, what if Norman Osborn was
a good guy?
Was the good guy, right?
It's kind of like Matt Murdock and Spider-Gwen.
Right.
Like Matt Murdock is a villain, which I hate seeing because I love Matt Murdock, but that's the whole fun with this is that in a parallel universe, he could have the same abilities and the same talents and go down the exact wrong path.
Yeah. I love that little twist. And he went the wrong way.
Yeah.
And he could have been so much greater. So they do have these even matches. You know, Norman has this brain, these ability and these powers. Spider-Man has his brain, his heart, and his powers and abilities. Plenty of things that make a great Spider-Man story is the Peter Parker of it all, his relationships, his friendships, the things that motivate him, the will to push forward. Even when he's beaten, he's not done. Really, really excited that we got to this point, and knowing that Dan was planning this was, this was the long game. This is where he was going to get to. He's one of those writers that thinks that way, and we're able to do it in such a big, bombastic way. Really pretty terrific. I would say it's the perfect ending to Dan Slott's 150-plus run on the book, but he's still got one more to go.
So,
what else is great is this Lockjaw issue.
Oh, man. Okay, so I'm going to preface this by saying that in my neighborhood, as we all know, Lockjaw is a giant bulldog who teleports. In my neighborhood, I met two American Bulldog puppies. They are 12 weeks old, and I don't know what their names are. I didn't quite catch them. I was talking to the very sweet family who owns them.
I'm going to name them Hercules and Golgotha.
That's adorable. I named them Meatball and Cupcake because they are tiny, and they're just, they've got these huge paws, even though they're so tiny. And the little boy who is Meatball, because the girl has to be Cupcake because she was cupcake colored. And he sat on my feet and he just guarded me like a good boy. It was just the most adorable scene ever. So that made reading and looking at bulldogs on the page even more fun. So this is the end of Lockjaw. This is the end of this run of Lockjaw by Daniel Kibblesmith, the writer, and inker Roberto Poggi. And it's another example of someone putting in such great care and drawing Lockjaw with such love and affection for dogs. I love Marvel's dogs and Marvel's animals when they're drawn by people who clearly have a connection with animals, because it just makes you love them even more. But we're starting out this issue on Adelan. So someone is running away with a swaddled something, and she's being chased. And then we find out it is a puppy. It is a baby bulldog puppy. And as we go along, we meet Lockjaw. Are they in the negative zone?
No, they're in the mindscape with Sleepwalker. This is Daniel Kibblesmith just having some funsies.
It's crazy.
Sleepwalker a dog, and they call it Dog Walker.
Yeah.
And
he doesn't quite understand the concept.
Just the best.
It's great. And it's kind of beautiful because he does not understand why people have dogs, but he just figured he'd whip one up. And this is a very grand-looking dog. It's the size of a horse, and he rides the dog.
I mean, it's probably normal Great Dane size, right? Like, Great Danes are massive
They
beasts.
Are giant, very huge dogs, and so sweet. They have no idea how big they are. But yeah, this dog looks like he knows how big he is. He looks very majestic, and he's also green. And
but this is super cool and super important, because this is the origin of Lockjaw.
Of Lockjaw,
because for many years, there was a lot of question. Well, was Lockjaw a person who through the mists was turned into a dog?
No.
Lockjaw is a dog. And what is also really cool is how Lockjaw's origin connects him to Black Bolt. Because Black Bolt was exposed to pterogenesis while in the womb.
Right.
And so that is essentially how Lockjaw was exposed to Terrigenesis as well. So it's this horrible situation.
It's so sad. It tears your heart apart to see it because it's we see Lockjaw's mother, and she's pregs with Lockjaw and also four other siblings. But only one of these puppies actually had abilities, and that was Lockjaw. But yeah, now his mission is to track down his siblings. And we've actually met a couple of them throughout the run. Bixby is one of them. And Doc Jaw, the scientist, is another one. Now he's looking for the rest. He's looking for the rest of his family.
One of the things that I loved about this issue was Lockjaw teleporting through different universes and places. So we get to see Sassy on his way to getting drunk, Odin on the throne being like,
"Yeah,
who are these people? Get them out of my house. I hate this place."
I love Sassy Odin.
Yeah. He's just like, "This sucks." And he's throwing his wine at them. D-Man gets turned into a giant dragon dude, which is dope. I love D-Man so much.
Yeah, I like D-Man too.
There's...
I think I've met a few D-Mans, like secret D-Mans.
There's this two-page sequence where we teleport outside a ship where Valeria and Franklin Richards are. So, you know, for those of you who are like, where are the Fantastic Four right now? You get a little peek. It is a great moment. Some really funny dialogue. And then they go to the Ultimate Universe, Duck World, this redacted universe.
Universe we cannot mention.
So good.
It's wonderful.
A prehistoric Earth. And it's comedy, and it's fun, and it's a good time. It's done for a gag. Really silly stuff.
Yeah, that's what I love about Lockjaw is that it's just purely silly. It just takes place in its own kind of zone.
But anyway, really wonderful, happy ending to this book, which made me happy.
Yeah, lots of pictures of dogs and a little visit to the Inhumans.
The ending of Daniel Kibblesmith's note and letters pages is great because he says, "Lockjaw will return in Death of the Inhumans, but I'm sure he'll be fine."
Yeah.
I mean, they wouldn't. I mean, they couldn't.
Just how heartless are we?
Right? So, yeah, we'll find out in Death of the Inhumans number one on sale July 4th. One more book this week, and that is Star Wars, Lando, Double or Nothing. Or is there a hyphen in there? I don't know. Sometimes we just throw a lot of extra punctuation in, and doesn't matter. It's a terrific friggin' issue, written by Rodney Barnes, art by Paolo Villanelli, colors by Andres Mosa, and letters by Joe Caramagna. And look, Solo, a Star Wars story, came out just this past weekend. I saw it. I had a grand old time with it. Watched the movie. One of the things that I said immediately was, man, wish we had more Lando and L337. And of course, this week we have more Lando and L3. And it's their dynamic, the bickering, funny banter between them is in full effect here. Rodney, who he's worked on at Runaways television show, he recently did the Falcon comic book series. He's worked on Boondocks and a ton of other shows and different projects. He nails the dialogue, the tone, the tenor, the rhythm of all the characters in here. And the book opens, and we talk about this, Tucker and I, on Marvel's The Pull-List, both the video and the audio version of one of my favorite panels being the first time you see Lando in this book. It's him staring straight at you, says, "It's sweet, but it could always be sweeter." And that is just, that's how you get things moving. He and L3 just going and getting themselves into some trouble. Lando, he's not a great guy. He's really like in it for himself. He wants new capes. Did you see Solo yet?
I haven't seen it yet. Who wouldn't want a new cape?
A wonderful sequence with all his capes.
I want to know what it's like to be Donald Glover playing Lando Calrissian and now having a comic with his likeness.
Yeah.
Because it is a perfect comic likeness of Donald Glover as Lando Calrissian.
Yeah, and big shouts to Paolo and Andres for really nailing that. It is not just the characterizations of Lando, it's the world of Star Wars. Paolo crushes it. We've got the Falcon in a dogfight with a couple of TIE fighters, and it feels big and fun and very Star Wars. This is before the events of Solo, the film. So
you can read this without spoiling anything for yourself.
100%. And this is both acts as a great compliment and a great precursor to the film, or on its own if you're not going to see the film, which I don't know why, because it's really fun. I love this issue. I think it's just going to be perfect for everybody who wants more of that Donald Glover Lando action.
I know I do.
All right. So Star Wars, great stuff. We also have great stuff with our interview this week.
Oh, super fun.
Yeah. With Amy Reeder and Brandon Montclair, who are co-creators, co-writers for Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur. I've never actually spoken to them before, but it was cool. We were talking about, you know, just the whole book that they've been working on for years with artist Natasha Bustos, as well as colorist Tamara Bonvillain. It's great to have like consistent creative teams mm-hmm. that they've been working together really well. And then they bring in a bunch of really talented folks as needed. Like for this issue, which we were talking about, which was Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur number 31, which comes out June 6th. They are working with Ray Anthony Height, who is just a great artist and hits all the tones that you need to hit for a book like Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur. He complements Natasha's art style. So it retains the flavor and the feel, the fun,
totally.
The youth and tone of the book so well. It's a special issue, really. I mean, it's a one-off. They're doing special in a number of ways. One, Amy Reeder, who recently, she stopped co-writing it with Brandon. She's working on a bunch of other projects. She's a very, very busy woman. She came back to help co-write this particular issue, which commemorates the World Health Organization's No Tobacco Day, which was May 31st, which is kind of like Christmas to me. I think
it's a great holiday.
Every day should be No Tobacco Day.
I agree with you. I totally agree with you. And this is a great, really fun way to have an anti-smoking message without being too much of a bummer, with it being informative and fun and very, very positive, which is, of course, where Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur are always coming from. So this is a super, super fun issue, but it's going to create a good conversation.
Totally. Also has something that is very near and dear to me for whatever reason. I don't even know why, but bees in New York City. I love it because saving the bees is super duper important.
I am personally scared of them, but I know that they're doing a very incredibly important thing for the ecosystem. It's not just honey. It's not just mean stings. Bees are very responsible for a huge part of how our environment works.
I have 100% escorted a bee out of the vestibule in my house into the outside. I'd be like, go bee. There's plants right there. There's flowers. Do your thing. But a wasp gets punched in the face.
Not having that.
Getting punched in the face is a dude named Swarm, who is cool. We'll talk about him a bit in the conversation with Amy and Brandon. But we also talk a bit about Lunella's teacher in this, which is a really cool part of the story. We'll dig into that a bit, but humanizing sort of the people who are struggling with that addiction.
And if you know someone who's quitting the way Lunella does, then be supportive of them. Like, hear them out. Be there if they're having craving. Yeah, you're not a villain. You're not a bad guy. You're not Swarm.
On that note, let's go right into the interview. Brandon Montclair and Amy Reeder, how y'all doing?
Good.
Hello.
Welcome.
Yeah.
Thank you. We feel welcome.
It's been really encouraging to see how much the fans have jumped onto and supported the work that you guys have done, along with Natasha and Tamara. It's just been great. So I just want to say congratulations.
Yeah,
it's awesome.
Congrats.
Really great. It's a fun book. And this issue that we're talking about specifically is issue number 31.
Mm-hmm.
What sparked this issue, specifically talking about smoking and the environment? Was there something personal about the topics that especially brought you back to script this issue in particular?
Especially the bees.
Them bees.
Yeah, them bees.
Brandon, how did it end up coming about originally?
Yeah, it was the editor, Chris Robinson's idea. And well, it was a fill-in issue between arcs, so kind of an opportunity just to do a standalone story. And it was Chris's suggestion. And as much as it's a nice message, a lot of it's kind of a wink to the old after-school specials and stuff. Like I said, it used to be more of that stuff in comics. So how do you kind of bring it into a comic that we're doing that is for all audiences and make it kind of fun and make it kind of cool? And then, you know, but also update it, but not be too cute with the message and say, oh, haha, we're just making fun of it. So trying to get a balance and do something interesting for an issue. And, you know, brought Ray Height, who's done a couple of the fill-ins that we've, when Natasha takes a month off. So it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. Plus, you have the smartest person in the whole world giving us really accurate information about the dangers of smoking. So it's coming from a place of knowledge, but also a lot of fun.
It's true. Yeah. It is a fun book. Like, we made sure to have that be fun. That. And honestly, like, because it feels a lot like a Saturday morning cartoon, you know, that you're doing a non-smoking issue, I felt like that was kind of the angle that we went for on that was, yeah, like making it kind of feel that way a little bit, having that moral, you know, stuff like that. So it was a tough balance because you wanted to do it realistically. You wanted it to hit close to home. But there's also a lot of levity in it, just the way that cartoons are able to handle something that's serious but can also be fun.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think it makes a lot of sense. And you guys handle it in a way that the kids who read it, which there are a ton of kids who read this book, which is so awesome.
It's great.
Yeah, they're going to see it, and I think they'll handle it in a cool way. But as Jamie said, we want to talk about the bees as well.
Yes.
I love me some bees. Mm-hmm. My wife is allergic to bee stings, so she's not as fond. But, like, we gave our upstairs neighbor here in Manhattan, like, a little place where the bees can come. Not a full hive, you know, mm-hmm. one of those deals.
Okay. But in your house?
Above, we have a roof.
I don't like them that much, but okay.
They do, as we learned in the book, they do so much good work for the world.
I'll give them that.
That's fascinating. I don't think I could do that.
There is a whole citywide industry of rooftop honey, though. That's kind
of. That's a bee dad.
Yeah, exactly.
they won't sting their dad.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about that. We just got to keep away the wasps. Wasps are horrible. Nightmare creatures. I hate them. But with the bees comes the cool villain use, which I love. And Ray, who does the art in this issue, killed it with Swarm. So creepy. There's like the... spoilers, sorry, there's a reveal with the beekeeper mask. And I was like, I honestly didn't see it for some reason. And it hit me. I was like, oh no, Swarm! So gross.
It was weird for me reading it because seeing the kids smoking was a lot more upsetting to me than seeing Swarm as scary as Swarm is.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think agree. That shows us who the real, what the real villain is in this story, as awesome as Swarm is. Like, there are real life dangers.
Yeah, we definitely, it mattered a lot to us to make sure that smoking was the real villain. And also to make sure that it hit close to home. Like, we're not just having, like, mean looking people smoking and stuff. Yeah. Like, it's people that Lunella knows. So I think that that's the part that was important to us. Like, we didn't want to come from a place of judgment, you know?
Some right.
of these, you have to think about the people who are reading this. And some people, some kids, maybe their parents smoke, you know? And you don't want to make them out to be a villain. You don't want to confuse them. So it is a really delicate balance of trying to figure out how do you address this, you know, and what role does Lunella play in all that?
Yeah, and I think the most sympathetic character was the teacher who said that she's basically been trying to quit smoking for 10 years, because that's really the truth of trying to quit smoking. I don't know this personally, but I used to work for a nonprofit that deals with this.
Wow.
And it takes so many tries to quit. And when you slip up, it's not necessarily a failure. It's just, you know, it's one more try. You just have to keep trying. And she obviously kept trying. And then she was faced with a moment where she was probably maybe going to have to try again.
Mm-hmm. The panel where she's like at her desk, and the cigarettes are on the table, and it's just so well done, and like the emotion there is so good. It comes across so well of like that struggle that she's going through, and her emotion of trying to convey to Lunella, like, I'm not angry at you for like, I'm angry at you for this, but I'm more trying to protect you from what I've dealt with. So that was really strong.
That moment was, it resonated.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. But the next few issues, you know, after this, we have these cool covers that feature photos with comic book art.
Which one's your favorite?
So I'm going to say probably the best cover Marvel has maybe ever produced is issue, 33 of Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur? I don't know why. I just feel like it's really, really strong, really resonates with, like, the cultural zeitgeist. It has nothing to do with me being on the cover. But how did that come together, and what's the connection to the next arc?
The next arc is called Save Our School. Again, this was Chris Robinson's idea to kind of do the old style photo covers where you have a photo and then drawing on top of it. So you incorporate drawing and photos. And yeah, what Ryan's getting at is that for one of these, is it 33? I believe it's 33.
I didn't pin that to my Twitter account and trying to figure out how many copies I can get so I can give it to my whole family.
Has Devil Dinosaur and Lunella walking along outside the windows of the Marvel offices, and somebody got chosen to have their desk typing away, doing their Marvel stuff, and plastered on the cover for all time. And it was cool. I for one of the days, I walked around and kind of found locations to take pictures of. And it's like one of those things where you take 1,000 pictures and you're looking for five decent backgrounds where you can make it work.
Yeah.
But it was really cool. Natasha had a lot of her own photo reference from kind of visiting the city and looking around. But, you know, it would be like you said, you had to remove Godzilla. Would be perfect. But there was, like, I remember one that had a Lay's potato truck. And it's like, oh, well, we can't use that. And, like, yeah, so you had to kind of get the right mix of the right city scenes. And then that would also work compositionally. So it was tough getting the locations. But it was just something, it was a fun idea. And those always stood out. It might even be before my time, right? You'd see them in like a back issue, been in a quarter box. I said, oh, look at that cool photo cover. So,
yeah, yeah. I was talking to Tom Brevoort, who's one of our longtime editors here at Marvel, because anytime I have a question about Marvel history, it's like, oh, I'll just ask Tom. Mm-hmm. He's not busy at all. He won't be bothered if I ask him a ridiculous question.
Right.
And I'll ask him, like, how many photo covers have we done over the years?
Right.
And he was like, there's only been a handful. Get away from me. I was like, yes.
I don't think you're the first Marvelite to be on the cover. And I think Innocente was dressed up as, like, Spider-Woman or something on one of the covers. Yeah, exactly, in costume.
That's
so
great.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Cool. That's super, super fun. Cool.
One of the things that I love is how... talking about these photo covers is just how much of a character and of New York is to the book and how seeped in New York it feels. So you guys live in New York, from New York?
I grew up here, yeah. And I lived up in Westchester County, which is like, you know, Marvel fans know, the home of the X-Men. But my parents were divorced. My father lived in the city. So I'm a New Yorker my whole life. But Amy came.
I came from Denver, but I've been here for 9 years and have been drawing New York since before that. So you just start to kind of pay attention. It's kind of funny because I've done so many New York centric drawings now that, like, when I'm showing my friends around to different sites, I'm like, oh, and I drew that and I drew that. Like, even if I'm not looking up, like, I'm just like, oh, there's the Chrysler building. That's where it would be situated because I drew all of these buildings, you know. It's really weird.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, you hear that in a lot of things in movies and TV. You want to make the city a character.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you know, we try to definitely take advantage of that because I think New York has always been such a big part of Marvel comics. And it's great and everything. Like I said, all great stories and all great art. But sometimes you see stuff like, well, that's not New York City. You know what I mean? When you see someone kind of walking through or something. Oh, look, I'm, you know, they call out a neighborhood and it really wouldn't look like that. Which is fine, you know, kind of telling the story along. But when you have to set it someplace, well, why not do something that's interesting and kind of makes a part of it.
Well, and Moon Girl is mostly, that whole story is mostly set around Yancey Street, which is supposed to be like a...
It's Delancey Street.
Yeah. Delancey Street.
Yeah. I love that, like, that's like Jack and Stan being like, we'll just change it to Yancey.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
And one of the few fictional Marvel, because everything's Manhattan
in
Marvel, but for some reason they changed the name.
They just decided to change it. Yeah, but I actually work really close to Delancey Street. So that was also like some of the motivation there because I could just go out because I have like a studio space, you know, so I just go out and take photos and stuff for reference for the artists. And
yeah, no, I love it. My mom's favorite movie when I was a kid was Crossing Delancey. So it's like, for whatever reason, that is always stuck in my head. Like, oh, we're crossing Delancey, like going down, you know, going into the city with her when I was a kid. But yeah, Yancey Street for me is so great to have Lunella there because it is just a natural part of the Marvel universe, making her situated with it. And I loved the arc with, you know, with Ben and Johnny and it. Mm-hmm. And it's just so cool. It's like, it felt right. It felt like family stuff.
Feels like home.
Yeah.
Well, there's always been a little bit of Fantastic Four because that's Jack Kirby created Devil Dinosaur, Moon Girl, something that Amy and I are created with Natasha. But half the book really is Devil Dinosaur. And Jack Kirby obviously created so many characters, but it's nice to, like, say to connect it to Yancey Street, and that's, you know, because Jack Kirby grew up in the Lower East Side. Also, tie it all into Marvel Universe with the Fantastic Four lore and put it all together is good because, yeah, you really want her to be a part of the world, you know, and Marvel. And I think that's, Amy and I have done creator owned work, and it's, you know, been successful. So you like doing that, and you like to control it. I've always been of the mind that if you're going to work for Marvel, you really want to be a part of Marvel. You don't want to say, oh, I come to Marvel and I'm going to do my own thing and I'm going to throw out everything else. I'm not going to pay attention to what they're doing. I mean, it's a balance because you do want to have kind of like do your own thing. But the only reason to come and work here and to create Moon Girl is to make her a part of the fabric of the Marvel Universe, I think.
Yeah, no, I think of like the kids who cosplay as Lunella, right?
Yeah.
And like I don't know,
one of you guys, or maybe it was is Natasha, posted like this video of this little girl walking around with a devil dinosaur.
Yeah, that's me. That's my video too.
With a leash. Exactly. Yeah.
And it was like, it just destroys me. It is the best thing.
The little tiny cosplayers.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, like, she was like not. She couldn't even talk yet. Yeah. And she was. No. And she had one of those like. Wasn't she on one of those like kind of kid leash things?
Well, yeah, but they, made it set look up like that she was leading. Yeah,
they made it look like the dinosaur was like on a leash and she was leading it around.
Yeah. No. It's amazing. And so I see that, or I see, you know, little kids reading Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur, reading it to their friends, reading it to their family, reading it to like that is so incredibly important and impactful that we're so close to it right now. We don't have a full idea of how much it's gonna mean.
It's true. Yeah. When they're older, right? Like we're like, I mean, that's kind of the goal, part of the goal, right? Is get new generations into comics. And no, it's been great to see. Like at first we had mostly adult fans, like when only single issues had been out and stuff. But of course then when the trade came out and then when we kind of cut a deal with like Scholastic and everything, we're just getting more and more kids reading the book, and it's really cool. Like, you know, and a lot of them, they're not gonna read the credits and know who made it. So like we'll be at conventions and kids will just all of a sudden stop and be like, what is this, you know? Like just in the last, I was just in Minnesota and like a lot of kids were really into it, and like one of them especially seemed like to be a big Moon Girl fan, and I had this little sketch that was sitting on my table as a sample of a commission. And she wanted it. And I said, well, tell you what, come back here at this time because I make people work. And I'll give it to you. And she came back. You know, they waited around so that they could get the sketch. So
wow. She really wanted it.
Yeah. You know, and it felt special. Like, I just, it feels like it's meaning a lot to kids. It's not just like, oh, I read this. Like, so it's just great to see. And honestly, a lot of that is to the credit of the team. Brennan is continuing to do this amazing job writing it. Like, now I've been reading it as a fan, and it's just genius stuff. Like, it's just so good. And Natasha is, like, she's getting better and better, and she was already great, but she pulls off everything we hand to her. And that is a big reason for the book's success. It's just that she can do anything. And Tamara is, like, the glue that brings everything together. She makes everything shine. It always looks better once her colors are on it, you know?
Yeah.
It's just an amazing team that's been really consistent. Ray's been doing great fill-in issues, including this one. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really part of it. It's just quality stuff. That's why Squirrel Girl has been successful as well. It's quality stuff, quality creators doing stuff that they put their heart
Heck
into.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, man, the art team, so good. It's like the book already feels like animated in a way. It's like got energy and it's peppy and it's poppy and it bursts off the page.
Well, and the artist was an animator before. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
Natasha Bustos. Yeah, yeah. That's where she came from.
Look at that.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
It all makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, plus Lunella's energy is just, she's confident, which I think is a really great thing to see in a little girl, because I guess it's a little easier when you're 9 because you're not really at that
before
age.
Before you become 12.
Yeah. Before you become 12, exactly. So I feel like she's a sort of beacon of hope. It's like, I'm a little insecure, but look at this girl. She's fine with everything. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't doubt herself. She knows she's the smartest person in the whole world. And I like seeing that because it makes me feel like maybe I'm the best something in the whole world. I just don't know what it is yet.
It's nice that she doesn't think twice about it.
Yeah.
That she's not strong-headed despite anything.
I hope she stays 9 so that age and the years do not change that about her. Because I don't know how it's decided about aging a character like Lunella. Like, I want her to maintain this spirit, this really pure confidence that she has. And maybe that wouldn't go away, but she'd have doubts about other things. So I don't know. I'm just speculating.
Yeah, she was a supporting character in Secret Warriors, right? And the writer, Matt Rosenberg, asked me, I want to do her birthday party. And actually, Natasha Bustos had an idea for a birthday that we might do one day down the road. Says, oh, like I said, she's going to turn 10. And I never want to be on the other side of that where some other, you know, using somebody else's character. And they say, no, don't do it. So Matt just made a good story. He said she just was pretending it was her birthday, so everyone would kind of come. and bring her presents and stuff like that. Yeah, exactly. Like that. But like as you're saying, yeah, it's like she's 9, and maybe one day we got a story that she'll turn 10, but it's tough, and you know, it's also you want to keep the book visually interesting. So you know, like I said, we were talking about Swarm, and it's like, oh, that's so many things you can do with the bees flying around, or the city in so many different neighborhoods, and kind of like to put the mood together. One of the things that I just like to do, basic things, is kind of change seasons. So we had like one arc that was in the winter, you know, instead of that kind of constant late spring, early summer that things usually are cast in. We had a Halloween issue where they're going around trick-or-treating, and like the next arc that's coming up after this anti-smoking issue is back in the fall. So it's like, well, you know, if you try to add it all up, it's not going to make sense, because there's going to be multiple Christmases and multiple season change, which is always
kind of like the Monty
old.
Python
yeah.
give way to spring, yeah, kind of. Whatever. Anyways.
But I think that is more beneficial to the book in the long run, right?
Right.
Like it's going to be an eternal book.
Right.
It's a book that a kid can pick up and it
Yeah, it's always about forever. A 9-year-old who's, you know, teleports a dinosaur and is the smartest person in the world and all the other stuff like that too. Yeah,
Am I crazy or was there a scene with like a future Lanella tease?
Yeah, there was. It's actually a short sequence and we switched up the art style. And it wasn't Natasha, and I'm trying to remember who does it. I want to say it was Leonard Kirk.
Yes.
But he did it in kind of a retro style, and it was Tamara did a great job kind of doing retro colors on it, and it was really cool. Maybe then it'll be revisited.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah. But, yeah, is it a dream? Was it real? Was it a vision of the future?
Yeah.
I don't know.
That's cool.
Is this my beautiful house? Is this my beautiful wife?
Very nice.
I was thinking about just kids reading it. Yeah. Whatever brings you to comics, I want to help you enjoy it, whether it's this book and this first experience. Hopefully it keeps you going because it's so amazing.
The first experience is everything.
Everything.
Yeah. And Moon Girl is such a good first experience because, first of all, it's Moon Girl, but also it's a devil dinosaur who is like Clifford the Big Red Dog, only a dinosaur.
Give us one last tease for the next arc and what's to come for the book.
Yeah, well, Save Our School, and a lot of the times you kind of you get in another world, or you get the Fantastic Four and Galactus and all these other stuff. I wanted to do a local story, and so it is about all the kind of supporting characters that you only see for a panel, or maybe they get a page. So it's their kids in their class, it's the teacher, it's everyone coming back, and there's a new kid in school causing trouble, and it's the Kingpin's adopted daughter, Princess Fisk. And she's a bit of a brat.
Of course, her name is Princess.
Yes, and that's the next arc.
We had talked before about the possibility of a entitled brat.
Yeah.
I'm excited. I really want
She gets everything she wants from her father, the Kingpin, who's also mayor of Marvel's New York City. But
yay!
I
want a big red dinosaur. I want a big dinosaur too, Daddy.
Big red dinosaur hangs out with Daredevil? Because that's so much red on the page, but so much fun.
This tree has a lot of red.
My wife and I are in the process of trying to adopt, and we're awaiting family. So I love any time I hear a story about, you know, adopted kids and all that kind of stuff, because there's a full spectrum of stories you can tell with that, which I think is great. And, you know, like, I look at that and like, oh, in X number of years, that's a story I can pull and be like, oh, look, this is a unique family.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, Kingpin maybe doesn't have the best reasons to, you know, maybe there's an ulterior motive.
Dun, dun, dun.
You'll have to read and find out.
Damn it, Wilson!
maybe he'll learn to love something too.
Maybe.
I guess we'll just have to read to find out.
Oh, stay tuned, you guys.
Awesome. Amy, Brandon, thank you for joining us on This Week in Marvel.
Thank you.
Spider-Man.
Okay, so hope you guys dug the interview. There is a video version of the interview. You can watch that on Marvel.com and Marvel social media, where we put all our videos and the YouTubes and all that good stuff. So check that out. Along with a bunch of other videos, there was one episode of Eat the Universe that went out this week that had really adorable Groot and Rocket Raccoon from Marvel Universe Live there. They were helping Justin make a trash
omelet.
Yeah.
I would eat that.
I eat omelets fairly often.
Omelets are great.
It didn't have cheese, as far as I could tell, though. And cheese is usually the thing that holds it all together. But it was like egg,
with it's rice.
Like Bonder.
Tikka masala. Was it
tikka? Chicken tikka masala. Was it
tikka
yeah.
masala, yeah.
Which is probably why I didn't have cheese, because it's got your cream element in
sure.
it.
Sure. That's yeah. fair. I've eaten Justin's cooking before. I know it's going to be good.
Yeah.
It's going to be amazing and delicious.
I trust that Justin knows what he's doing.
Yes.
My takeaway was that this is a really excellent conversation about food waste, which is a major issue because people throw away perfectly edible food just because it looks or seems like it might not be good. So he takes a bunch of things that look like they should be thrown out and he actually turns it into something called a trash omelet, which is actually does look really good.
One of my favorite things from the episode is also Justin watching Marvel Universe live.
Yes.
And it just looks like he's just a child.
Which
is great because we did a whole segment for Thwip, the big Marvel show, when that was still running, behind the scenes with Marvel Universe live. I watched the show surrounded by children who were losing their minds. It was
yeah.
like they were just freaking out because they were seeing their superheroes in front of them. It's this wonderful experience. So great. The things that those performers can do is wild. Oh, one other thing. We talked about Clash a little bit earlier in Amazing Spider-Man. Ramon Perez, who did some Clash stories in Amazing Spider-Man, some tangential stuff a couple years ago, he is on Marvel's Quick Draw this week telling a really cool story about what he's working on and how he's relates to his parents, which I found really fascinating.
I love that.
And he was showing him drawing Malekith and Dario Agar, the giant Minotaur dude, in the Thor at the Gates of Valhalla one shot. Just gorgeous stuff.
It's just really fun creators talking about creating, which I always really like. Because one of the things that he said that I thought was really kind of cute was that when he was a kid and he would see the art, he's like, I just thought it sort of happened. And he's like, he never really realized, like, oh, this is a thing that I can do and make money at it.
Yeah.
And now he's making that stuff that just sort of happened. He's making it happen.
Making it happen.
Making it happen.
You know who else is making it happen? Our community. When they tweet us using hashtag This Week in Marvel, or they email us at twimpodcast@marvel.com. Raph AB, first up, he says, got pretty bored at work today, playing a lot of Marvel Strike Force to get a little busy. Marvel Strike Force got me some Cable. I got me some Deadpool. Doing really well. Our This Week in Marvel Alliance, killing it.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, they're crushing it. They're doing great work. It's really fun. Raph also asks about the stripperoki that popped up in the X-Men wedding special. You have some questions. We don't have those answers, Raph.
Sorry, Raph.
I can't say that either of us has ever been to a stripperoki.
No.
No. Toshi Mitsuhashi had tweeted to Kevin Smith that he enjoyed the interview. Enlightening and truly amusing. I like that. We got a couple of tweets in here. H.P. Seton was really excited. Wanted to say that the discussion about writing Daredevil was so fantastic. And thanks us for great content each week.
Oh,
thank
you're
you,
welcome.
H.P. We'll finish up our community segment. Simon Williams picked Falcon 8 as his Twim of the Week. He wants to see Sam, Misty, Sean, and Blade team up more often.
As do I.
Yeah. It's terrific. Finally, last one this week is from our pal Brian Stranko, who's in my This Week in Marvel Alliance on Marvel Strike Force. He says, apparently it was around episode 333 that I started listening to the podcast because I finally heard Agent M mention the start of our conversation as I chipped away at the back issues. It's fantastic to have binged so many podcasts and suddenly have shout outs in one.
Is this the singularity?
Uh-oh.
Is this what happened?
It's all coming together.
This is, what are we going to do?
No. All right. So our question of the week, would you rather have Leopardon, Japanese Spider-Man's giant robot, which is also a ship called Marveler.
And comes with a homing device
yep.
that you wear.
Or would you rather have the Millennium Falcon? A giant robot that is also a ship? Or the coolest ship in all of
the galaxy, yeah.
Like, it's a tough question. I know my answer would be to have Leopardon, because giant robot trumps everything else.
Since I'm not into flying, I feel like I'd also go with Leopardon, because I can get him to do the flying for me. And he can also probably fight my battles while I sit back and have a nice coffee. So,
he's got to have a coffee machine in that robot somewhere. So, guys, let us know what you would want. Would you rather have Leopardon or the Millennium Falcon? Tweet us using hashtag This Week in Marvel and email us at twimpodcast@marvel.com. We'll be back with another episode next week. Next week I'll be here, but the week after that, I'll be on a trip.
Another trip. Oh, no.
Yeah, we'll talk about that next week. Right now, I'm Ryan.
And I'm Jamie.
This is Marvel.
Your universe.
Change the apartment. Kimi wa naze, kimi wa naze, tatakai tsuzukeru no ka, inochi o kakete. Hitosuji ni, hitosuji ni, muteki no otoko, Spider-Man.